From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, the state's top NCAA coaches enlist in the effort to get the public to wear masks.
One of the great things about athletics, sports in general, is that it crosses political lines.
This, even as the outlook for college sports and colleges themselves is getting darker. Also, one scholar looks at efforts to diversify a university's student body and faculty and why those efforts didn't work.
They chose the value of a premier elite university over that value of access every time.
A new book has an unprecedented look into admissions, hiring, and services at the University of Michigan. And a Michigan ensemble commissions a new work celebrating one of Detroit's cultural hubs.
There was a lot of hustle and bustle, teeming with people. There were musicians that would actually just sing on the street sometimes.
It's a tribute to Paradise Valley. That and more just ahead. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, how racial disparities in higher education persist, even when there are good intentions for change.
They chose the value of a premier elite university over that value of access every time.
That's coming up later in the program. But first, Governor Gretchen Whitmer has used her latest press briefing on COVID-19 to push for more Michiganders to wear the mask in public to help stop the spread of the virus. And in her comments yesterday, she tapped a very specific group of people to help get the word out. Basketball coaches. Tom Izzo and Susie Merchant were there from MSU. Kim Barnes-Arico was there from the U of M. Everyone encouraging people to mask up. And they unveiled this ad with elite coaches from several sports across the state.
As rivals, we don't always see eye to eye.
Like who scored the best recruits? Who's going to be who?
And whether we wear green
or blue.
But one thing we can all agree on, to help stop the spread of COVID-19,
wear a mask.
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 The ball's in your court, Michigan.
Such times with sports figures encouraging public health measures. We're throwing this one over to Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. John, welcome back.
Thank you, April.
So if Anthony Fauci can't convince them, is Tom Izzo going to be able to get the job done?
This is one of the bizarre, crazy things about college athletics, April. Izzo's chances are better in the state of Michigan than Fauci's. It ain't right, but there it is.
You know, some of the coaches said, hey, you want your kids to go back to school this fall, wear your mask. Sobering, if not completely surprising. I don't know that I've heard university presidents speaking that bluntly.
But they should. And what I cannot comprehend in this, one of the great things about athletics, sports in general, is that it crosses political lines. Izzo, Juwan Howard at Michigan, of course, who knows who they voted for? It doesn't matter. They all want the same thing. And people get behind that, I think, usually. Everything else gets so politicized so quickly, including the mask. And I can't fully comprehend how this has happened. It seems to me, for example, if you wanted Trump to get reelected, you'd be the first guy arguing for everybody to wear masks to bring the COVID down to increase his chances. So I don't get the current lines at all. And this is as good a chance as any, I suppose, in getting the word out. We've done a poor job as a society of beating that drum.
Let's talk about college students for a minute. We've all seen the photos of the parties, nobody wearing a mask, no social distancing. Do you see a subtext in the coach's video for younger people?
Absolutely, because these are the guys on campus that probably the students admire the most, recognize most readily. I guarantee you that in all those cases, Juwan Howard and Tom Izzo are more recognized than the presidents of those universities. So sad but true, there it is. So your chances do increase, and why not? It takes, you know, a minute to cut that ad and get the word out. So your chances increased.
Yeah. Some college athletes have been able to get back to campus and start training, although, of course, there are schools like Ohio State that suspended voluntary workouts. Have you heard anything about how training is going at this point?
It depends on where you are, both in terms of how well it's going and how much they're going to tell you. Now, in Michigan's case, and God bless them for this, they got the word out on their COVID response rates so far in the first week, and the numbers are extremely good. Out of 500-some athletes, two or three have gotten it so far, a minuscule number. Now, whether that continues during the workouts, especially with the return of other students, that remains to be seen, but so far, so good in that case. Obviously, Ohio State saw fit to drop their voluntary workouts, and by the way, put voluntary in quotes on that one, April.
at Ohio State, yeah, for sure.
Or anywhere. Look, right. I dare you, don't show up and see how voluntary it is.
Right.
Maryland also had to cut theirs. Clemson cut theirs for a while. So it's been happening around the country.
Have you been able to pick up on whether the athletes themselves sound very concerned about infection rates right now?
Not directly, because we don't have much access these days. But the ones I've been able to reach here and there, yeah, they're concerned. And they get one thing that the public often does not get. It's not simply a matter of life or death. Will I survive COVID? You know, the death rates and so on is what everyone talks about. These guys are, you know, world-class athletes, and many of them have got their eye on the NBA or the NFL. And they know that if their breathing is compromised long-term, they're not going to get there. So to them, they're more sophisticated, frankly, than most of us that see it as life and death. They know it's life and death and how much baggage you carry out of this. So they're very concerned.
Do you know anything about how programs like Michigan or MSU are running their workouts? I mean, I'm assuming they're social distancing, right?
They absolutely are, but it's a very difficult thing. And the CDC, as you know, has ranked activities on the danger scale from 1 through 10. And going to gyms and going to bars are basically 8s and 9s. It's a very difficult environment to run cleanly. Now, luckily, at most of these programs, they're highly staffed. They've got great facilities. That's one of the bonuses here. And they're manic about sanitation already before this, I believe. I saw it in practice. So their chances are as good as any gym out there. But you still have 120 athletes, you know, trading barbells and breathing hard and all the rest. It's a very tricky thing to pull off.
You know, I don't worry so much about a program like Michigan being able to get their facilities in a place where everybody could work out, everyone could lift weights in a way that was a little more sanitized than usual. But I just wonder how the smaller schools are going to deal with this with limited budget.
You hit the nail on the head. It's not going to be the Michigans and the Ohio States who suffer from this. It's going to be the Eastern Michigans. It's going to be Adrian College. It's going to be the small schools with limited resources, facilities, coaching staffs, and so on, and expenses to pay for this, which is why one of the things that is going to come out of this in a year is a lot of schools are going to start dropping a lot of sports. That is almost certain.
Well, not that there are a lot of winners in this situation, but my hat's off to you. You jumped out in front of this in April and said that college football isn't going to happen. Has anything changed your mind?
No, sadly, it's become more obvious, I think. I was guessing then. Now it's more of a prediction, I guess. I'm fairly solid data. And of course, what do you get on Twitter these days, April, as we all know? You get blowback. Hey, man, why is all the negativity? And dude, I write college football books for a living. Are you kidding me? This is strictly against my self-interest, I guarantee you. But the college football is the hardest sport to pull off. You got five guys in the line on each side. They're breathing hard. Look, these guys spit at each other after a play in normal conditions, let alone these conditions. It's going to be extraordinarily hard to pull this off, and I frankly don't think it's going to happen.
Well, I remember you saying that college sports is actually harder to pull off than NFL football under these restrictions. Why is that?
A few reasons. One is that the NFL's got 54 players in your roster versus 120 on a college football roster. The NFL guys, they can quarantine themselves. They can go to home and practice at home, no problem. The college guys can't do that. You're in the dorms, the classrooms, the houses. Of course, they're socializing, fraternities, bars, house parties, and so on. You're interacting with the world in a way that an NFL player is not. Furthermore, morally, you would say that an NFL player, you sign the deal. Okay, I get $3 million to do this. That's the risk I choose to take as an adult out of rational self-interest. A 17-year-old, an 18-year-old has not got that kind of freedom, nor those incentives. So if you want a gigantic class action lawsuit, stick around a college campus in about 5 months, you might get one.
Even with the disclaimers that many schools are asking people to sign.
And by the way, the disclaimers, you're asking these kids to, and often they are kids, they're 17 in some cases, asking them to sign a waiver that you're not going to sue if you get sick. That's not going to hold up in the court of law, for one thing. Second of all, if you have to ask a player to do this, think twice about what you're doing. To the credit of Michigan, Michigan State, they have not done this.
So, John, you have talked about the fact that, in Michigan's case anyway, that the football budget is in many ways separate than the university's budget. But are there ways in which a lack of a football season is going to hurt the university's bottom line?
Yes. The finances cut two ways. One, the simplest on paper, I can tell you, it's overrated, the damage done, because everyone thinks that football program is such a big deal financially, and it kind of is. But the entire budget of the athletic department, all sports, about 30 sports, is $185 million. The budget for the university is $7 billion with a B, and half of that goes to the healthcare system, the hospital, the medical school, and so on. So basically, the hospital spends the athletic budget on rubber gloves every year. Mm. It's nothing in that sense. The flip side is what it does as an intangible for development, for rousing school spirit. And a friend of mine, Jerry May, who finished the $6 billion campaign for the endowment recently, I asked him once, you must have seen every Michigan football game. And he said, I've been to them all and I've seen none of them, because that's when you raise money. You're there courting donors on football Saturdays. And every school at Michigan does this, engineering, education, you name it. So as a vehicle for raising money and drawing people in, football is unmatched. And that is a loss.
Okay, so the $64,000 question, when push comes to shove, would you care to predict which sports might be on the block?
At Michigan, probably none for the first year. Beyond that, it gets tough. Nationwide, the easy ones are everything but football, basketball, and hockey. The non-revenue sports used to be called that for a reason. Gymnastics, baseball, things like this are very hard to maintain year in, year out for a lot of schools. There's about to be a big shakeout in college athletics.
Well, John, wait a minute. I mean, you can't tell me that some of the smaller sports like crew rowing are that much of a drag on university budgets anyway. Don't a lot of those non-revenue sports raise most of their own budget anyway?
Depends on the program and who's doing it. And any smart coach of a rowing program or a lacrosse program has got big donors lined up. It's how you build facilities and so on. So there is some of that, no doubt about it. But the cost these days of, I mean, a women's basketball program loses $3 or $4 million a year every year. That's just the way it is. Doesn't mean it's not important or not valuable, but it's not a moneymaker. You can't say that. And most sports are in that category. Again, football, basketball, and occasionally hockey make money. In Michigan's case, softball, I think about breaks even thanks to Coach Carol Hutchins. But those are rarities. And that means 26 sports are losing money.
John U. Bacon is the author of many books, including Overtime, Jim Harbaugh and the Michigan Wolverines at the Crossroads of College Football. He is also Michigan radio sports commentator. Good times, John.
Good times, yeah.
You take care.
Keep saying that, April.
Right. Bye-bye.
All right. Take care.
Next up on the program, a new composition celebrates the history of Detroit's Black Bottom and Paradise Valley neighborhoods, vibrant centers of the city's Black life. That's after the break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. A lot of people, when they look across Detroit, they see ghosts. People they've known, for sure, but also the places that we once knew, places that are part of history now. In particular, the entertainment district known as Paradise Valley. The heart of Detroit's Black life, it was a business and entertainment hub where people came to hear music and shake off their day. All through the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. This was where you went to hear artists like John Lee Hooker, Duke Ellington, Billie Holiday, Sam Cooke, and hosts of others. Paradise Valley was torn apart for the construction of I-75, and while Black life in Detroit certainly went on, it's difficult to calculate the value of that loss. And yet, are this place and these people really ghosts to us? A 25-minute composition in tribute to Paradise Valley will premiere this month as part of a virtual event by the Acropolis Reed Quintet. It was composed by Jeff Scott of Oberlin College faculty and the Imani Winds. Matt Landry joins us now. He's the executive director and saxophonist for the Acropolis Reed Quintet. Matt, welcome to Stateside.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Also with us is someone who'll be taking part in the premiere events as, I guess, sort of dramaturg. Marcia Music is a writer and documentarian of Detroit stories. She grew up in Highland Park in a very musical family, and I think we can say is a city treasure. Marcia Music, it is a pleasure.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Marcia, you would have been pretty small when Paradise Valley was still a working community, and I'm guessing as a kid you weren't in the clubs very much?
No, it was before my time, although Paradise Valley, there were remnants of it that actually still existed into my adulthood.
Your dad was the eminent record producer Joe Von Battle, and he worked with this whole constellation of gospel and blues artists and also ran a record store right on Hastings. Do you think people understand the economic vitality of those times?
I think that fortunately what is happening, there is a generation of storytellers, writers, community griots who are keeping these memories forefront and returning these areas into the public domain and the public consciousness. And those people who grew up in those areas, who are now elders, you know, they're still around. You know, they remember those areas very well. So they're not long ago ghosts for them. That was their growing up.
What would we have seen and heard walking around the neighborhood?
Well, it depends on the neighborhood. These were actually three very distinct neighborhoods. Black Bottom, which is now Lafayette Park, Hastings Street, which was a thoroughfare running from the river to East Grand Boulevard and Avenue, and then Paradise Valley, which was further north, which is now basically the sports stadiums.
Let's take Hastings, where your father had his business. What can you, could you sort of evoke the scene for us?
Well, it was a street of great density. Detroit was very dense in those days, and those communities were very dense, even commercial districts. There was a lot of hustle and bustle. It was teeming with people, replete with activity. There were musicians that would actually just sing on the street sometimes. Sometimes there were people that would get on crates and stand up and preach and talk. Even Malcolm X was one of those people. And people would sing, and Johnny Hooker would walk up and down the street with his guitar.
That man don't love you. He told me so. On the job.
There's a very famous, iconic photograph of Johnny Hooker and his guitar standing right in front of my dad's record shop that was taken by a French photographer who was writing a book about Detroit in 1959. So it was a very active and busy place.
For folks who want to see it, that photo is part of a very beautiful remembrance that Marcia wrote of her dad. That's available with a quick search. We'll post it up in the show's Twitter feed as well. Matt, I wanted to ask you what was helpful in grounding yourself in the things you needed to know for Acropolis to take on this project.
Wow, that's a great question. And a great question because not only are we, you know, an all-white classical music ensemble, but none of us are actually natives to Detroit. Really, what grounds us is the art that we create. So we want to make sure that the art is created authentically from a voice that's authentic to the struggle of these Black communities that have been raised all over the country. So in this case, we started in 2018 with Jeff Scott, a composer not from Detroit and who had never really been to Detroit, who was from New York. And so he could empathize with much of what was happening. He's a Black composer and plays in what was at the time of its founding, the Imani Winds, the first wind quintet of entirely people of color in the United States, really of any prominence. So we brought Jeff out. He learned about this history. We learned about this history. Jeff created this piece of music, Homage to Paradise Valley. Then we got in touch with Marcia. And then really, as everybody can hear already from talking, from hearing her just a little bit, you get a more visceral and really grounded. I mean, you really get grounded in terms of what it was like and what we lost, what we all lost in these neighborhoods being destroyed. And so now we've actually played the piece 30 or so times live before even getting in touch with Marcia. Now we're doing this soiree to have Marcia on, and she created this new poetry that goes along with the piece. And now we're going to do more live performances whenever live performances happen again. And it's got a new sense of grounding and a whole new experience now for us when we perform it.
Right. I want to talk a little bit about one of the movements in the piece that Jeff Scott created. It's called Club Paradise Jump. Could you describe, Matt, what that particular movement is trying to capture?
Yeah, so Club Paradise Jump, or I think we actually just renamed it to Paradise Theater Jump, it evokes the Paradise Theater, which is now Orchestra Hall, where the Detroit Symphony Orchestra plays. But at that time, it was essentially a jazz concert hall, jazz, blues, and it brought in all the great Black artists from all around the country. And a jump was a really up-tempo dance that was done in the 40s and 50s. And so that final movement, the Paradise Theater Jump, is just a celebration of all the music that took place at that time. As it is also jazz-inspired, it is also very technical and classical, which is what Jeff Scott, the composer, what his real speciality is. So it's his way of connecting us back to this older jazz music that was so popular and prominent. I mean, it's just so hard to put ourselves in a position of understanding how popular this music was and how much it just drove everyone to get up to dance. It was just everyday life. And so it just, the final movement, the Paradise Theater Jump, just tries to capture that a little bit in just a real exciting piece of music.
Before I ask this next question, Marcia, have you heard that movement?
Yes, it is thrilling. The entire work is thrilling.
Is it even possible to capture Paradise Valley in music? That kind of sounds like a tall order.
I think that it is a classical work that evokes those places in a different idiom than we're accustomed to hearing. It is not a jazz work. It is not a bluesy work. It is a classical work. And I think that its importance is that in the classical world, ensuring that this history, this important cultural bedrock, be acknowledged and celebrated in the classical idiom.
This movement has a real roll and bounce to it. Matt, can you talk about catching the energy of those musical forms without parroting them, per se?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's interesting because I'm, as the saxophonist of the group, I'm probably the member that has, well, I'm definitely the member that has the most relationship and experience with jazz music. I said I grew up in New Orleans, and it's very much a part of me. I do improvise. I do play some other idioms. So what we try to do when we play music that is inspired by other forms of music that are not classical is we try to just push ourselves a little bit to learn about them and to make sure that we are playing in our own style, but in a way that's authentic to the energy that we need to have. And so in this case, it's actually in the Paradise Theater Jump, a lot of it comes down to the tempo, it comes down to the momentum, and the way that Jeff writes the bass line, boom, beam, boom, beam, boom, beam. It's a question of, it's kind of offset, it's not really straightforward, so how do you keep that moving, and how do you get all the other notes to interlock? So to be honest, once you've done that in this fourth movement, the Paradise Theater Jump, it kind of plays itself. It's a lot of fun.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Matt Landry. He's the executive director and saxophonist for the Acropolis Reed Quintet. And also with us is Detroit writer Marcia Music. Matt, you mentioned just a minute ago that Acropolis is an all-white Reed Quintet. Why was it important for you guys to interpret a work on Paradise Alley? I mean, what did you feel like you could bring to this story?
Well, this all started in our approaching Jeff in order to create a substantial classical work of music for us. And then after talking to him about what he might compose, he kind of chose to lean into this history of Detroit that as an outsider, he didn't know. And so Marcia had stated that it's very important that classical music begin to open itself up to other ways of thinking about music. Frankly, classical music, I think in order to survive and to continue to thrive, needs to continue to be open-minded about what it is. There are even really great and substantial questions in the classical music community being asked right now about the value and the elitism of the written note as opposed to the improvised note or the just heard and spoken word in song. And classical musicians tend to think that their music is the best because it takes so much time to write and it has so much complex theory behind it. And we just want, as a group, to bring our best selves as classical artists, classically trained in conservatory, so to speak, to something that stretches our own abilities, that brings in new sounds and new perspectives. So as far as Paradise Valley goes, you know, we want the composer who writes a piece for us to find something that they can express themselves through. And this was something that Jeff really, when he found out about it in visiting Detroit with us, he just really latched onto, and he just knew this was going to be what he wanted to express. So from there, our job is just laid out for us. It is now plain and clear. We now have to have that same vision as a group.
Marcia, can you tell us, without tipping your hand too much for the performance, some of what's been on your mind as you prepare the spoken word aspect of the program?
I had realized some months ago that I had never actually written a piece on Black Bottom per se, or on Paradise Valley per se, or on Hastings Street per se. I had done writing on my father's record shop and the community in which it existed, but I got this message from Matt asking me would I participate in this project, and I thought, well, this is a good opportunity for me to do this work that I've been wanting to do. I love doing epic poems, long rhyming chronicles on aspects of life in Detroit. And then when I heard that the composer was a Black composer that was wanting to explore this community of Black Bottom, Hastings, and Paradise Valley, well, that really gave me an opportunity to try to work my poem into those three sections and to just try to capture in a form that I think is appealing in order to give people a sense of the history of that time and the dynamism of life and of Black life and the enterprise, the musicality of life during those years. And so that's what I think I brought to this.
The places that we're talking about are places that Black Detroiters didn't have a lot of choice about inhabiting. I mean, when Ford started hiring, the real estate world was not selling to Black families. And yet, people made so much and created so much and built so much and lived so much in places like Paradise Valley. Marcia, would you say that that duality was very much in the minds of the people who worked and played there?
Yes, that's a good observation, because that tension of the dichotomy of being, on the one hand, basically compelled to live in very restricted places, but at the same time developing such human endeavors because of it, this pressure cooker of the concentration of people, of various classes of people living together. You know, because of the segregation of that time, Blacks didn't have the ability to live in places other than very few communities in Detroit. It was quite a synergy of classes and of the dynamic culture that developed during that period of time because of this closeness in these communities. That really helped to really explode commercial endeavors, businesses, because we could not shop in the businesses like Hudson's. We were not allowed in those places. So this community created its own kind of downtown on Hastings Street. And it was a place where Black people exercised their creativity and their entrepreneurship. And so really, you could say the roots of Motown are even in Black Bottom, with Berry Gordy's father being a business owner in various areas in and around Black Bottom, various businesses. So the segregation in which the community was compelled to function also at the same time compelled people to exercise this great creativity.
Detroit writer Marcia Music. We've also been speaking with Matt Landry, the executive director and saxophonist for the Acropolis Reed Quintet. The new work that Acropolis commissioned, celebrating Detroit's Paradise Valley, will premiere in virtual soirees through July 19th. And Marcia's part of the event as well, with spoken word and stories from Paradise Valley's past. Information's on their website. Marcia, Matt, thank you both very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. After a break, a new book digs into what the University of Michigan got right and got wrong in its efforts to diversify. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Michigan's wrenching conversation about equity has a way of reframing all kinds of different issues in our lives. Institutions that white people consider progressive are not necessarily viewed the same way by Black Michiganders. There's a new book that has laid out an extensive paper trail at the University of Michigan and the school's efforts to provide a diverse environment for higher education. In most ways, the author explains the university achieved almost the opposite effect. Matthew Johnson is an associate professor of history at Texas Tech University, and his new book is Undermining Racial Justice: How One University Embraced Inclusion and Inequality. Matthew Johnson, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
We should say as we begin that Michigan Radio is a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan, just to get that bit of housekeeping out of the way. The purpose of the book was to show that the U of M adopted some of what Black student activists have demanded over the years in an effort to be a more equitable place for people to study and to work, but that the university did so selectively in favor of other values. Let's start with a bit about the university's founding and the values that were sort of inherent to its creation. Could you lay out a bit of the history?
Yeah, I mean, right from the start, when the regions start to meet, they have these two competing goals. And one of them is to be one of the premier universities in the entire country, not just a premier public university, but just premier university in the nation. And then they have this other goal that's there to provide access, broad access to all people of Michigan. But what I started to find once I dove into that early history in the 19th century was at every turn, when those values started to clash up against each other, they chose the value of a premier elite university over that value of access every time.
I wanted to ask a little bit about your research process. You yourself as an academic have some experience and understanding of how institutions of higher learning function. What were you most curious about?
Geez, I was curious about what administrators were actually thinking when they were putting these things together. You know, universities just aren't transparent enough about these things. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book is, you know, if we look at these really divisive issues in our country that we talk about all the time and debate all the time, the general public really don't know much about how things like affirmative action actually function. And so I wanted to just take some of the mystery out of that. And in all fairness, you know, mystery for myself too, even though I work in institutions, I don't really know how admissions work very well before I started this book. And I didn't really know exactly how affirmative action admissions worked before I started this book. And so it was taking some of the mystery out for me too.
I want to talk more about admissions, but first, I just wanted to ask, could you give us an example of an everyday aspect of student life, maybe, for example, student housing, and give us an example of a university policy where administrators sort of undermined what they said they wanted to do?
So right from the start, I mean, really beginning in the mid-20th century, administrators had this idea about creating this multi racial community that would better race relations. And in the dorms, they started to figure out, one of the ways that they did this was they said, we're going to make sure that students can't choose roommates based on race. And it sounded like a really good idea in the mid-20th century. But what they started to do was bring white students and African-American students together in the dorms. And African-American students experienced this intense racism and also social alienation. And so as they started to experience that, especially by the mid-1960s, Black students started to say, hey, why don't you give us the opportunity to live with another Black student? And of course, we're going to be within this larger dorm where we're constantly going to be interacting with white students. But just give us this little space to be together in the dorms. And the University of Michigan said no. And Black students try to create lots of different small spaces on campus as areas where they could go to be exclusively with other Black students. And the university again and again said, no, that's not possible.
What interested you about the period that sort of followed the 1960s, a time when many students, and not just Black students, were speaking out about the need for a more inclusive and integrated environment?
Yeah, I really wanted to see, you know, especially after the 1960s, going to the 1970s and 1980s, there's this amazing period, especially in the late 1960s and early 1970s, where students really seem to have a lot of power. And they win some victories at the University of Michigan. But I wanted to see what happens after that. What happens after they don't have that sort of organizing power?
When sit-ins aren't, you know, the order of the day and things are going back to what mainstream America thinks of as normal.
Yeah, that's right. When they don't really have that same sort of organizational power, administrators really take back over the agenda of racial justice. When they're not worried about the consequences of their actions, it goes back to status quo.
Tell me a little bit about what you learned about the evolution of admissions policies at the university.
Yes, this is one of the more surprising things that I learned. So early on, the University of Michigan creates its first affirmative action program in 1964. And it was largely focused on working class Black students living in Michigan cities, especially Detroit, but also Grand Rapids and Flint. And by the mid-1970s, that completely changes. They changed their focus to focus on middle-class African-American students, mostly living outside of cities. If they look at cities, they are only focusing on these select admit high schools. And if people are listening from Detroit, they'll recognize the two high schools that the University of Michigan selected students from, and that was Cass and Renaissance. And that's largely the only two schools that they're willing to recruit from in Detroit. And so it's the shift from kind of a working-class focus to a middle-class focus.
What does that signal to you?
That signals to me that administrators really aren't interested completely or wholly in this value of equity and access.
Some of the narratives around higher education, the idea that a school like Michigan could or should be really grounded in merit and qualifications. I mean, no doubt this was a value that administrators showed they were committed to, but it also feels like the kind of thing that might make donors want to give to the university. And you point out that, you know, there's definitely evidence that some of the people who were involved in drafting the University of Michigan's policies really did, you know, aspire to change. You know, they said it even as decisions were being made that totally undermined what they were trying to do. There were people of good faith being involved in this. Do you think there is a nexus between what activists need out of universities, what students need out of universities, and what universities need to do to stay financially vital?
Yeah, I think that, you know, that comes in, especially when we start talking about diversity. And one thing that administrators have been really good at, and I argue in the book it's a bad thing, but administrators have been really good at turning student diversity into a marketable value, almost a monetary value, in which they can get lots of money from donors and celebrating its diversity. But they can also market the university to white students as this wonderful place where you can come get an education. And it's part of that really expensive tuition that you're paying for at the University of Michigan is your access to students of color.
Do you see that still playing out at the university to this day?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, this is part of the ambiguity of diversity. despite the fact that, for example, African-American numbers have gone way down, the University of Michigan still sells itself as this amazing, diverse place. And the concept of diversity allows administrators to do that because it's not attached to a number, right? It's like, how many Black students do you need to create a diverse community? How many next students do you need? How many Asian-American students do you need? How many Native American students do you need? Administrators, they never attach a numerical value to that. But numbers can go up and down, no matter what, and they can still sell the place as a diverse community.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with historian and author Matthew Johnson of Texas Tech. His new book is called Undermining Racial Justice: How One University Embraced Inclusion and Inequality. And it looks at the University of Michigan's attempts to diversify its student body and faculty, and the resulting status quo that emerged. I think a lot of the things that the average person knows about the University of Michigan's policies on race come from two very high-profile Supreme Court decisions that happened in the early 2000s, Gratz versus Bollinger and Grutter versus Bollinger. And they, in effect, ran a sword through affirmative action policies. Could you talk about what you see the decisions having done to the U of M's approach?
Very little, actually. I mean, they're in the undergraduate practices, of course, they had to change the mechanisms in their actual admissions practices. They were giving a specific point value to every African-American applicant. But the sort of goals that they had and the values that they had, the way that they generally ran admissions, didn't change very much afterwards. And in fact, despite the fact that there might be comments in the media about how this might be a loss behind the scenes, even Gratz, which the University of Michigan lost, was a huge victory for the University of Michigan. And certainly Grutter was a bigger one. But the Supreme Court endorsed the argument that the University of Michigan didn't need to recruit low-income students. It endorsed the idea that diversity could be a very ambiguous thing, not attached to any numbers. It endorsed all sorts of things the University of Michigan was already doing. And so when you go back in and look at, well, how did Gratz and Grutter really affect Michigan? It's not much.
Justice Sandra Day O'Connor wrote in the Grutter decision that the court expects that 25 years from now, and I'm quoting here, the use of racial preferences will no longer be necessary to further the interest approved today. So it's 2020. We're 17 years out, not 25, but I wonder about your assessment of what she wrote in that decision and where Michigan stands right now.
She's come out and made the comment that she's kind of regretted that comment that she made in that decision. One of the reasons why I think she regrets it, if you look at a place like the University of Michigan and look at the number of Black students that are on campus, their share of the student population today is about the same as it was in the late 1960s. That's amazing to think about, that before the big, very famous Black Action Movement strike in 1970, and afterwards, Black student population goes up to about 7% by the mid-70s and then goes back down. But we're back to a period before the Black Action Movement strike of 1970 in terms of student population. We've gone backwards since these big student strikes of the early 1970s.
Was it difficult to get the source materials that you needed to write the book?
Oh my gosh. I was really naive when I started this book because I thought I was going to write a big national study of affirmative action around the country. I was going to pull back the mystery from affirmative action all throughout the United States. Realized pretty quickly what I think a lot of people realize is that universities are not very transparent about what they're doing. And universities around the country have generally hidden, got rid of, or have locked up these sorts of sources. If I wanted to do research at Harvard, Harvard locks up their stuff for 50 years, and so I could only get up to 1970. The University of Michigan is a really special place. There's no university in the entire country that's made available as much of its past as the University of Michigan. And so they have memos, research reports, all sorts of communication between low-level and higher-level administrators about racial equity and affirmative action. I would never have been able to write this book about any other place.
Wow. Not even schools that you've worked at.
That's exactly right. I've actually filed FOIA requests at schools that I've worked at, and I've gotten very little back.
Oh my gosh. Have you come to any conclusions about what it means to let go of more traditional virtues, you know, the very traditional values of academic merit and qualifications as they have been understood through the 19th and 20th centuries. And if we were to think about building a population that more closely mirrors the state, did you come to any new conclusions about what that would look like?
The most basic one that I think has to happen, and of all the things that I came to, this is going to sound hard, but it's the easiest to do, is that we need to disconnect the way that we measure the quality of an institution or its elite status from the supposed quality of the student body at the time that they apply. Right? So if you think about how we measure the quality of institutions or the reputation, it's by the SAT scores of students when they apply, the high school grades of students when they apply. It has nothing to do with the quality of education that happens once they're there. So if you imagine if we rated hospitals this way, imagine if we rated hospitals by the health of patients when they show up and check in versus the quality of care that they get when they're there. That would sound crazy to us, but we're willing to go with that sort of system in higher education. And it's a system that creates racial inequality.
One of the things that struck me as so significant in the book is you really spent some time outlining what happens when you channel efforts of inclusion into one office or one administrator or one executive, instead of making it part of the institution's entire ethos. Could you talk a little bit about what that difference can mean?
Yeah. So one of the techniques that the people really high up at the University of Michigan used to be able to resist change. It was after a movement, after a big social movement or protest, they would create this new position, whether it's a diversity officer or assistant to the president, someone that looked like a very important position. And they would give it virtually no power to do much of anything, no budget, no power to hold people responsible. And that doesn't produce any sort of change at all. I mean, the only power is the hope that that person can go around the university and convince people with power to make changes, which never happened. There's a big difference when you force people who already have power to accept the idea, to embrace the idea of racial equity and put that into practice. That has rarely ever happened at the University of Michigan.
You know, it was kind of disheartening to read the book and just read example after example of what you're talking about. There'd be a spike in public interest and student interest in meaningful change, and there would be, you know, proclamations and new positions created. And like you say, these weren't necessarily very toothsome and didn't result in a lot of change. Obviously, the country is going through a huge conversation right now about how institutions can change. What have you learned about how institutions can start to seriously approach questions of inclusion?
Yeah, I think that it starts at the top of the university. And it starts at the top with a president holding people accountable for their actions, holding people from the top, from the people right below that person to the bottom. And that means potentially firing people. It means potentially connecting their raises to following through on racial equity goals. But it always starts at the top of an institution and holding people accountable for their actions. Otherwise, there might be change in one part of the institution, but not another. And an entire university has to change to make the quality of life much better for African-American students.
Matt, you've spent a truly massive amount of time researching and analyzing U of M's racial disparities and everything the school did to try to rectify the situation. Do you feel like you got one big takeaway out of all this about what worked and what didn't?
You know, the one big takeaway I have from this book is that, you know, seeing universities as bastions of racial justice is a huge mistake. The story isn't one of administrators giving in to every or even most demands of activists, but the real story is this resistance to change. And what's even more amazing that I found in this book is the story is these administrators who are resistant to change and involved in perpetuating racial inequality, that these people somehow in their mind convince themselves that they're champions of racial justice.
Matthew Johnson is an associate professor of history at Texas Tech. He's just published a book called Undermining Racial Justice: How One University Embraced Inclusion and Inequality. Matthew, thank you so much for your time today and for the book.
Thank you for having me.
That's Stateside for today. Tomorrow on the program, we'll speak with Olympic champion gymnast Jordan Weaver and her mother, Rita. The Caroli Ranch in Texas not only trained the nation's best gymnasts, but also helped foster the abusive atmosphere that made way for Team Dr. Larry Nassar. That's coming up tomorrow. We hope you can join us. I'm April Baer. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.